Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, as we devote today's program to coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings, we will pick it up live again in just a few minutes. We're expecting right about 5 minutes from now when Senator Orrin Hatch, a leading Republican on the committee for a long time, begins his questioning of Judge Sotomayor. Let's talk again to Jamie Floyd, host of Best Defense on the Legal TV network In Session. She used to also help vet judicial nominees for the Clinton administration. And Jamie, I want to go back to the tough questioning of Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, in the last half hour. He quoted some things from Sotomayor's so-called wise Latina speech.
Yes.
That were not just that phrase that's gotten repeated over and over again. And in fact, I want to tell our listeners that because that's been taken so out of context, we decided to go ahead and post about a 450-word excerpt from that speech that includes the phrase wise Latina, but that puts it in a much fuller context. So if you want to see that, we've posted that on our blog. Just go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you can see about 450 words of context around the wise Latina remark. But at the end of the passage that we took, I'm going to read you this paragraph, Jamie, because she writes that to understand others takes time and effort, something that not all people are willing to give. For some, their experiences limit their ability to understand the experiences of others. To me, that's as interesting a line as anything else in this speech. Mm-hmm. For some, their experiences limit their ability to understand the experiences of others. Others simply do not care. Hence, one must accept the proposition that a difference there will be by the presence of women and people of color on the bench. And she was referring specifically to a difference in the outcomes of discrimination cases, that a difference there will be by the presence of women and people of color on the bench. And then she concludes it by saying, personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. And Sessions ripped into her for that last line. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. And she was running away from the word choose. But she said it, and she said it on some other occasions, too. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because most of the conversation about this speech and beyond just the now infamous line about the wise Latina has been about the perspective of the woman, presumably Sotomayor. But I see it as much about the perspective of the other members of the court. So the benefit that the white male would have in sitting next to, say, the Latina woman or the black man, you know, has Scalia benefited sitting next to Clarence Thomas? I think perhaps he has. I think diversity is not just about the perspective that Sotomayor brings to the court, but it's also about the benefit that others receive in being exposed to those who are not like themselves. And, you know, I, of course, Brian, we've discussed this before, come at this from a very personal point of view, sharing much in common with Sotomayor, coming from the projects, coming from New York City as a woman of color, et cetera. It doesn't necessarily mean that you will see things differently from a white man of privilege, but I do think your life experiences inform who you are and what facts you see as a judge, as a doctor, as a subway conductor. I just think it's impossible for them not to. We're not robots. We're human beings. And we wouldn't want robots to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, or would we?
And argue. Well, I certainly wouldn't want a robot to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, unless that's a new kind of diversity as artificial intelligence progresses. But maybe that's a debate for another century.
A frightening debate for another century.
Still, she said that, I mean, she's really implying there, and she did actually say it in her testimony, that if you don't acknowledge where you came from and how that affects your perception, then you're more likely to make bad rulings and rulings that don't follow the law than if you do acknowledge them. She said, I tweeted this earlier because it jumped out at me, in every case where I acknowledge my sympathies, I do so to make sure they don't affect my ruling on the law. And that's not an exact quote, but that's a summary of what she said.
Paraphrase, right.
You know, and there's a tendency, I think, in this country on the part of many white men, at least traditionally, to assume that they're sort of normal, neutral, and that everybody else is coming from a perspective. Right. And then I think there becomes a blind spot to what their own perspective is. You know, maybe Sessions or some of the others who question in this direction, who seem to believe that you can just completely be blind to whatever your experience has been, you know, don't see that they're not blind to whatever their experience has been. That doesn't mean they're not acting in good faith, but that this may be a blind spot.
Well, I think there is as a matter of history, an assumption that the norm is the white male perspective. And for a long time, and some of my best friends are white men, but for a long time, white men have had the luxury of not having to grapple with some of these more difficult issues. Now, of course, not white men who've been on the U.S. Supreme Court. They, by definition, have had to grapple with some of the more difficult issues of the day, including those related to race and gender and the like. But the norm is no longer the white male perspective. And I think the blind spot to which you're referring, a lot of it has to do with the generational divide. And Sessions and his more senior members of the committee, colleagues, are on one side of that generational divide. Al Franken, I mean, he's not as young as perhaps we think of him because he's a comedian by training, but he's perhaps on the other side, the more junior members. And perhaps that divide will shift and we'll start to have less of a norm in our thinking as diversity increases on the court and elsewhere. But you know, two women and one Latina on a 9-person court, I'm not sure how representative that is of the larger culture. And the court only has 9 people on it. How representative can it ever really be?
Let's bring in another white male, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, who's at the hearings.
I've never met Todd, so I don't want to make an assumption.
Well, I have, and I'm outing him. As a white man. Hi, Todd.
I think I saw you at the club, Brian. That's how you know I'm a white male. You and I were at the same meeting, I think.
Yeah, we were allowed in, right?
Right.
Todd Zwillick, Jamie Floyd, Todd Zwillick. Todd, is the tough exchange that she had with Senator Sessions, is there a sense that we're going to hear a follow-up on that when Senator Hatch begins his questioning in another couple of minutes? Or I know he said something that seemed to be critical the other day of some of Senator Sessions' pre-hearing remarks, though he didn't mention them by name. Is this going to be softballs from a Republican, or are they going to continue to bore in on questions of identity politics?
Well, you know, actually, Senator Hatch is about 10 feet from me right now, and I wish I could ask him that question. He's just walking right beneath me. Boy, I'd like to ask him if he'd like to come on the air, but he's in a conversation. Look, I think Senator Hatch has been an advocate for the dignity of these hearings. He has been a critic of Judge Sotomayor, some of her rulings and some of her statements. He is a conservative, but as a longtime member of this committee and former chairman, he does sometimes tend to criticize pointed remarks even from his own side of the aisle, as you mentioned, Brian. But he's also one of these senators, and they exist on both sides of the aisle, who like to try to defer to the president's right to put nominees on the court and in cabinet posts unless there's something grievously wrong with them. And he has said that over and over. And as after Judge Sotomayor was nominated, he did say over and over in press gaggles that while he wasn't prejudging her nomination, he did think that the president had the right to put who the president wanted, unless there was something just unqualified or grievously wrong with this person's record. So I think you can expect tough questions and pointed questions, but Hatch these days doesn't play the attack dog in these proceedings the way he did maybe in the 80s, if we remember back to hearings with other nominees, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, other nominees who come before the committee. I dare say he's mellowed a bit.
I want to play an exchange on this question of perspective because it's so fascinating. Just to, again, let our listeners know the schedule of things, we have a few more minutes than we thought we were going to have because after Senator Cole's questioning, they decided to take a 10-minute break before Senator Hatch comes on. So I think we have about 4 or 5 more minutes now before Senator Hatch's questioning begins. This is from All Things Considered yesterday. Robert Siegel interviewing another of the Republicans on the committee, Senator Grassley from Iowa, and you'll hear Senator Grassley actually make the case that experience does not matter to a judge's perspective of life and of the law. Listen.
Hopefully I've been consistent. You know, I have voted for every Supreme Court justice that is on the bench now except Stevens because he was there before I got there.
Let me tell you something about Stevens. I want to ask you a question about that justice in particular and about this notion of empathy. His father, as you may know, was wrongly convicted of embezzlement when Stevens was a young man, and then he was vindicated. Wouldn't an experience like that make a person who sits on the bench think differently about the fallibility of the criminal justice system than another judge might? Don't our individual experiences in some way color the way we would answer a supposedly objective question?
If I were Justice Stevens, I wouldn't even have to use the example of my own father. All I'd have to do is use an example of when justice has not been given to an individual that deserves justice. And that happens in our society. And when there's an injustice, that ought to be corrected. And you don't correct much of an injustice to an individual by passing a law. Once in a while, through a private bill, it happens.
Right.
But that's what the judicial branch of government is all about, to render justice. And Justice Stevens could render that sort of justice regardless of whether his dad had a bad experience or not.
Senator Charles Grassley with Robert Siegel on All Things Considered yesterday. And Jamie Floyd, I mean, he really dug in on that position, that an experience of being wrongly convicted of a crime yourself would not affect your understanding of the criminal justice system any more than seeing intellectually from the outside that happened to somebody else.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to hearing
that?
Well,
with all due respect, I think it's silly. I appreciate, as an intellectual matter, the goal of our system that judges strive to be objective, but we have to understand that in reality, as we said earlier, Brian, they're human beings. And so the goal of a 9-person court is to have 9 objective judges that we know will be on some level influenced by their experiences, which is why the founders have 9, not 1, not even 3, 9, because we want some level of diversity up there. That's the notion. 9 heads are better than 1. This is why we have 12 jurors, not 1, on a panel in a criminal court. So I think each jurist is supposed to work mightily not to allow personal experience to unduly influence one's understanding and interpretation of the law. In other words, you're not supposed to make law. You're supposed to apply the law as it currently exists, but you're not supposed to do that fully ignorant of the way in which society works. If you know that there's injustice in the world, that's a fair thing to keep in mind when reading the law as it exists, the precedents and the legislative law that's been passed by the Congress.
Todd Swillick, do you think that Sessions laid a glove on her, politically speaking, in any way that's going to affect the proceedings from here on out? We heard Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, yesterday say very candidly to Judge Sotomayor, you're going to get confirmed unless you have a complete meltdown. Sessions taking her apart on this question of her perception that other people's experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. Is he setting her up for something that's that could be devastating to her?
Well, I don't think devastating, not yet anyway, because that would depend on the meltdown factor. Or, you know, she, look at her performance. She was solid. She expected the questions. She's been, not only has she been a prosecutor herself, she knows what prosecutors do. She was one. So she knows all the tricks. She was prepared for those questions. She's been through the so-called murder board over at the White House. That's the insider term for the rehearsal process that you go through when they throw really, really tough questions at you. Some say they even insult the nominee to make sure that they don't get rattled if they're insulted in a hearing. She was prepared for those. And by the way, about Lindsey Graham, he did say that he thought she would be confirmed unless she had a meltdown. But don't expect Lindsey Graham to not go at her. He has said he has lots of problems with her statements, lots of problems with her speeches and some of her rulings. So he may be acknowledging that they probably can't do much to defeat her. At least not yet. But I wouldn't expect a Lindsey Graham is also a former prosecutor in the military, a judge advocate general. He's a military JAG. Don't expect him to take a kid glove approach to her.
Jamie Floyd, do you think that Justice Souter is, in a way, the best argument against Sotomayor's position that experience matters? Here is somebody who lived, you know, almost the most opposite life from her that you could imagine. She grew up in dense housing projects in the Bronx. He was from this isolated background in New England before he was plucked by the first President Bush, with hardly anything being known about his judicial record or his philosophy or anything. They went through a phase back then where the only way to get somebody through a Supreme Court nomination was for them to kind of be a blank slate. And then this, you know, white male from an isolated, non-diverse background turned out to be one of the most liberal judges on the court.
Yeah, and as Bert Newborn pointed out, you really can't predict what a justice will become once they have the freedom of that life appointment. And it's not so much about knowing you can't be kicked off the court as it is the awesome responsibility that the appointment brings and that the judgeship brings. So I think perhaps Souter does point up sort of the fallacy of the entire discussion we're having, that there really is no way to predict what she will be or will not become. You know, I want to point up, since you've posted the entire text of her wise Latina speech.
Well, not the entire text, but we posted 450 words.
450 words,
around that phrase.
I want folks to note that she says in the text, she says, "I would hope that a wise Latina, I would hope." So it's not a definitive statement about Latina women. And she also says a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. So she's not painting white men with a broad brush. She's acknowledging that white men across the board have lived many different lives of economic circumstance, et cetera. You know, it's been, I think, misinterpreted, misunderstood, and deliberately so by some. And, you know, when we go out and we speak at colleges, universities, on panels, et cetera, we very often, and I think sometimes foolishly, assume that people will assume our best intentions as human beings. And sometimes they don't. And in her
right.
case, she probably thought that she would inspire some young Latina women in the audience without realizing that at some point in the future her words might be used against her, even
right.
though she really meant no malice to anyone, and white men or anyone else.
And one other thing about the context of that, it was specifically in response to a question about discrimination cases. So she
right.
was talking about the value of diversity on courts
right.
when having a full, trying to have a full perspective, as full an understanding of possible as possible of race and sex discrimination cases that were coming before the courts. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's gotten also lost and generalized to mean that wise Latinas in general will make generally better law on everything. We're going to take a break. We'll continue in a minute. Coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings. The senators and the judge are filing back into the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room. After a break, we're going to hear Senator Orrin Hatch's questioning of Judge Sotomayor as soon as it begins, probably seconds from now. Todd Zwillig, want to set the scene for us?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I'm going to lower my voice a little bit because, as you said, the hearing has restarted. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. I hear Senator Leahy taking care of business in the background.
Yeah, he's taking care of business. Senators have filed back in. The nominee has just filed back in as well. A lot of the senators aren't back in the room. Al Franken is down there in his lowest seniority position on the Democratic side, but there aren't any other Democrats in the room right now. A few Republicans, John Cornyn and Lindsey Graham, are here. Jeff Sessions just walking in the room now, taking his seat next to Chairman Leahy, and Orrin Hatch is next up with his questioning, and we were talking a little bit about what approach he might take to questioning Sonia Sotomayor, and we will see. I will give you a little bit of color from the break. It's interesting that Al Franken, who yesterday made a point to point out to everyone that it was just his fifth day in the Senate, has been making a point to walk around the dais and meet people on the other side of the aisle. He had a couple warm conversations with Orrin Hatch and then drew about 15 photographers to him when he went and sat down next to Lindsey Graham.
All right.
And then, of course, everybody came over to snap pictures like that.
So it's introduction day for Franken as well as Judge Sotomayor. Now Senator Hatch is beginning his questioning, and he's asking Judge Sotomayor about the law of so-called partial birth abortion, and here's her first response.
Conclusion that the right is not fundamental. Now, in the 2004 case entitled United States versus Sanchez VR, you handled the Second Amendment issue in a short footnote. You cited the Second Circuit's decision in United States v. Toner for the proposition that the right to possess a gun is not a fundamental right. Toner, in turn, relied on the Supreme Court's decision in United States v. Miller. Last year, in the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court examined Miller and concluded that, quote, the case did not even purport to be a thorough examination of the Second Amendment, unquote, and that Miller provided, quote, no explanation of the content of the right, unquote. You're familiar with that?
I am, sir.
Okay. So let me ask you, doesn't the Supreme Court's treatment of Miller at least cast doubts on whether relying on Miller, as the Second Circuit has done for this proposition, is proper?
The issue before...
Remember, I'm saying at least cast doubts.
Well, that is what I believe Justice Scalia implied in his footnote 23. But he acknowledged that the issue of whether the right, as understood in Supreme Court jurisprudence, was fundamental. It's not that I considered it unfundamental, but that the Supreme Court didn't consider it fundamental so as to be incorporated against the states.
Well, they didn't decide that point.
Well, it not only didn't decide it, but I understood Justice Scalia to be recognizing that the court's precedent had held it was not. His opinion with respect to the application of the Second Amendment to government regulation was a different inquiry, and a different inquiry as to the meaning of U.S. Miller with respect to that issue.
Well, if Heller had already been decided, would you have addressed that issue differently than Heller? Or would you take the position that the doctrine of incorporation is inapplicable with regard to state issues?
That's the very question that the Supreme Court is more than likely to be considering. There are three cases addressing this issue, or at least I should say three cases
right.
addressing this issue in the circuit courts. And so it's not a question that I can address. As I said, I bring an open mind to every case.
I accept it. In Sanchez v. R., you identified the premise that a right to possess a gun is not fundamental. and the conclusion that New York's ban on gun possession was permissible under the Second Amendment. But there's not a word actually connecting the premise to the conclusion. Without any analysis at all, that footnote that you wrote leaves the impression that unless the right to bear arms is considered fundamental, any gun restriction is necessarily permissible under the Second Amendment. Is that what you believe?
No, sir, because that's not, I'm not taking an opinion on that issue because it's an open question. Sanchez
so you admit it's an open question?
Well, I admit that Justice, the courts have been okay. addressing that question. The Supreme Court, in the opinion authored by Justice Scalia, suggested that it was a question that the court should consider. I'm just attempting to explain that U.S. versus Sanchez was using fundamental, in its legal sense, that whether or not it had been incorporated against the states. With respect to that question, moreover, even if it's not incorporated against the states, the question would be, would the states have a rational basis for the regulation it has in place? And I am, I believe that the question there was whether or not a prohibition against felons possessing firearms was at question, if my memory serves me correctly, if it doesn't. But even Justice Scalia, in the majority opinion in Heller, recognized that that was a rational basis regulation for a state under all circumstances, whether or not there was a Second Amendment right.
Well, in the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court observed that, quote, it has always been widely understood that the Second Amendment, like the First and Fourth Amendments, codified a pre-existing right, unquote. And the court also observed this, quote, by the time of the founding, the right to have arms had become fundamental for English subjects, unquote. Now, the court also described
for some
the right
context,
to have
arms they're talking about the Supreme Court ruling a year ago, a 5-4 ruling that struck down the Washington, D.C. handgun ban and affirmed that the Second Amendment protects an individual civil right to own a gun that has no connection with service in a militia. That's the case they're talking about now, Orrin Hatch trying to get at the gun rights attitudes in a legal and constitutional sense of Sonia Sotomayor.
To the states.
Well, what's your
the question?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What's your understanding of the test or standard the Supreme Court has used to determine whether a right should be considered fundamental? I'm not asking a hypothetical here. I'm only asking about what the Supreme Court has said in the past on this question. I recall, for instance, the court emphasizing that a right must be deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition, that it is necessary to an Anglo-American regime of ordered liberty, or that it is an enduring American tradition. I think I've cited that pretty accurately on what the court has held with regard to what is a fundamental right. Now, those are different formulations from the Supreme Court's decisions, but I think the common thread there is obvious. Now, is that your understanding of how the Supreme Court has evaluated whether a right should be deemed fundamental?
The Supreme Court's decision with respect to the Second Circuit incorporation, Second Amendment incorporation doctrine is reliant on old precedent of the court, and
right.
I don't mean to use that as precedent that doesn't bind when I call it old. I'm talking about precedent that was passed in the 19th century. Since that time, there is no question that different cases addressing different amendments of the Constitution have applied a different framework. And whether that framework and the language you quoted are precise or not, I haven't examined that framework in a while to know if that language is precise or not. I'm not suggesting it's not, Senator. I just can't affirm
sure.
that description. My point is, however, that once there's Supreme Court precedent directly on point and Second Circuit precedent directly on point on a question, which there is on this incorporation doctrine and how it uses the word fundamental, then my panel, which was unanimous on this point. There were two other judges, and at least one other, or one other panel on the Seventh Circuit by Judge Easterbrook has agreed that once you have settled precedent in an area, then on a precise question, then the Supreme Court has to look at that. And under the deference one gives to stare decisis and the factors one considers in deciding whether that older precedent should be changed or not, that's what the Supreme Court will do.
Okay, as I noted, the Supreme Court put the Second Amendment in the same category as the First and the Fourth Amendments as pre-existing rights that the Constitution merely codified. Now, do you believe that the First Amendment rights, such as the right to freely exercise religion, the freedom of speech, or the freedom of the press, are fundamental rights?
Those rights have been incorporated against the states. The states must comply with them. So to the extent that the court has held that,
right,
then they have been deemed fundamental as that term is understood legally.
What about the Fourth Amendment about unreasonable searches and seizures?
As well.
Same.
But with respect to the holding as it relates to that
Understand.
Particular amendment.
Let me turn to your decision in Maloney versus Cuomo. This was the first post-Heller decision about the Second Amendment to reach any federal court. Or federal appeals court, I think I should be more specific. In this case, you held that the Second Amendment applies only to the federal government, not to the states. And this was after Heller. Now, am I right that your authority for that proposition was the Supreme Court's 1886 decision in Presser versus Illinois?
That plus some Second Circuit precedent that had held that it had not been, that the amendment had not been.
But Presser was definitely one of the
It was, but
cases
it,
you relied on. Okay, in that case, or I should say that case involved the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause. Now, is that correct? You're aware of that?
It may have. I haven't read it recently enough to remember exactly.
You can take my word on it.
Okay. I'll accept.
Thank you. Last year's decision in Heller involved the District of Columbia. So it did not decide the issue of whether the Second Amendment applies to the states or is incorporated. But the court did say that its 19th century cases about applying the Bill of Rights to the states, quote, did not engage the sort of 14th Amendment inquiry required by our later cases, unquote. Now, here's my question. Am I right that those later cases to which the court referred involved the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause rather than its Privileges and Immunities Clause?
As I said, I haven't examined those cases recently enough to be able to answer your question, Senator, but what I can say is that regardless of what those cases addressed or didn't address, the Second Circuit had very directly addressed the question of whether it viewed the Second Amendment as applying against the states. To that extent, if that precedent got the Supreme Court's teachings wrong, it still would bind my court.
No, I
and to the
that.
Extent that Justice...
I'm talking about something beyond that. I'm talking about what should be done here. It isn't the Presser case that you relied on in Maloney to say that the Second Amendment does not apply to the states one of those 19th century cases where they used the Privileges and Immunities Clause, not the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, to incorporate. See, the later cases have all used the 14th Amendment, as far as I can recall.
As I said, Senator, I just haven't looked at those cases to analyze it. I know what Heller said about them. In Maloney, we were addressing a very, very narrow question. And
Right. In
the end, the issue of whether that precedent should be followed or not, it's a question the Supreme Court's going to address if it accepts certiorari in one of the three cases in which courts have looked at this question.
Well, the
Court of Appeals has.
The reason I'm going over this is because I believe you've applied the wrong line of cases in Maloney. Because you were applying cases that use the Privileges and Immunities Clause and not cases that use the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. Let me just clarify your decision in Maloney. As I read it, you held that the Second Amendment does not apply to state or local governments. You also held that since the right to bear arms is not fundamental, all that is required to justify a weapons restriction is some reasonably conceivable state of facts that could provide a rational basis for it. Now, am I right that this is a very permissive standard that could be easily met, the rational basis standard?
Well, all standards of the court are attempting to ensure that government action has a basis. In some
right.
situations, the court looks at the action and applies a stricter scrutiny to the government's action. In others, if it's not a fundamental right in the way the law defines that, that it hasn't been incorporated against the states, then the standard of review is a rational basis.
And my point is that it's a permissive standard that can be easily met. Is that correct?
Well, the government can remedy a social problem that it is identifying, or a difficulty it's identifying in conduct, not in the most narrowly tailored way, but one that reasonably seeks to achieve that result. In the end, it can't be arbitrary and capricious.
Well,
that's a word that is not in the definition.
Maybe
of
I can use the words more easily met. How's that? Okay.
As I said, the rational basis does look more broadly than
right.
strict scrutiny
that's
may.
That's my point. As a result of this very permissive legal standard, and it is permissive, doesn't your decision in Maloney mean that virtually any state or local weapons ban would be permissible?
Sir, in Maloney we were talking about nunchuck sticks.
I understand.
Those are martial arts sticks.
Two sticks bound together by rawhide or some sort of a...
Exactly. And when the sticks are swung, which is what you do with them,
right.
if there's anybody near you, you're going to be seriously injured because that swinging mechanism can break arms, it can bust someone's skull,
sure.
it can cause not only serious but fatal damage. So to the extent that a state government would choose to address this issue of the danger of that instrument by prohibiting its possession in the way New York did, the question before our court, because the Second Amendment has not been incorporated against the state, was did the state have a rational basis for prohibiting the possession of this kind of instrument? So it's a very narrow question. Every kind of regulation would come to a court with a particular statute with legislative findings as to why a remedy is needed. And that statute would then be subject to rational basis review.
Well, the point that I'm really making is that the decision was based upon a 19th century case that relied on the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which is not the clause that we use to invoke the doctrine of incorporation today. And that's just an important consideration for you as you see these cases in the future. Let me just change the subject. In the Ritchie case, and I'm very concerned about that because of a variety of reasons. The court split 5-4 on whether to grant summary judgment to the firefighters. And it was a summary judgment, meaning it didn't have to be distributed to the other judges on the court. The only reason that Judge Cabranes raised the issue is that he read it in the newspaper and then said, I want to see that case. Then he got it and he realized, my gosh, this is a case of first impression. So the court split 5-4.
3-2. 2-1.
No, it's 5-4 on whether to grant summary judgment to the firefighters. Now, even the four dissenters said that the firefighters deserved their day in court to find more facts. But all nine justices disagreed with your handling of that particular case. Now, thus, your decision in Ritchie, I mean, even though there was a 5-4 decision, all nine of them disagreed. with your handling. Now, okay. But as you know, your decision in Ritchie versus DiStefano has become very controversial. People all over the country are tired of courts imposing their will against one group or another without justification. Now, the primary response or defense so far seems to be that you had no choice because you were bound by clear, longstanding precedent. Most say you were bound by Second Circuit precedent. Some say it was Supreme Court precedent. So I need to ask you about this. To be clear, this case involved not only disparate impact discrimination, but both disparate treatment and disparate impact. That's what made it a case of first impression. The city says that they had to engage in disparate treatment or they would have been sued for disparate impact. So it was how these two concepts of discrimination, disparate treatment and disparate impact, relate in the same case. But back to the issue of whether you were bound by clear, longstanding precedent. As I recall, your opinion in this case, whether it was the summary order or the per curiam opinion, did not cite any Supreme Court or Second Circuit Court precedent at all. Is that right?
I believe they cited the Bushy case.
Okay. The only case citation, in your opinion, was to the district court opinion because you were simply adopting what the district court had said rather than doing your own analysis of the issues. And I think that is right. But you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd be happy to be corrected. But didn't the district court say that this was actually a very unusual case? This is how the district court put it, quote, this case presents the opposite scenario of the usual challenge to an employment or promotional examination as plaintiffs attack not the use of allegedly racially discriminatory exam results, but defendants' reason for their refusal to use those results, unquote. Now, this seems complicated, I know, but you know more about it than probably anybody here in this room. The district court cited three Second Circuit precedents, but didn't two of them, the Kirkland and the Bushy cases, didn't they deal with race norming of test scores, which did not occur in this case?
They dealt with when employees could prove a disparate impact of a case and
but
whether they would
be... But based upon race norming.
But the principles underlying when employees could bring a case are the same when they establish a prima facie case, which is can an employee be sued, employer be sued by employees who can prove a disparate impact. And the basic principles of those cases were the same, regardless of what form the practice at issue took.
Okay. Well, the third case, the Hayden case, didn't it present a challenge to the design of the employment test rather than the results of the test?
I'm sorry, say this again.
The Hayden case, didn't it actually present a challenge to the design of the case rather than the results of the design of the employment test rather than the results of the test?
Again, regardless of what the challenge is about, what test is at issue, the core holding of that precedent was that if an employee could show a disparate impact from a particular practice or test or activity by a employer, then that employee had a prima facie case of liability under Title VII. So the question is, was the city subject to potential liability because the employees, the city of New Haven, because the employees could bring a suit under established law challenging that the city of New Haven had violated Title VII? That was the question.
Okay, it's one of the reasons why it's a very important case. When the Second Circuit considered whether to review the decision en banc, didn't you join an opinion admitting that the case presents, quote, difficult issues, unquote?
Well, the district court noted that it was a different scenario, But it evaluated its decision. It evaluated the case in a 78-page decision and gave a full explanation, one which the panel agreed with by adopting the opinion of the district court. Those questions, as I indicated, are always whether, given the risk the city was facing, the fact that it could face a lawsuit and its conclusion, that perhaps a better test could be devised that would not have a disparate impact, whether it was liable for discrimination, different treatment under the law. The Supreme Court came back and said, new standard. As I understood the dissenters in that case, what they were saying is, to the majority, if you're going to apply a new standard, then give the Second Circuit a chance to look at the record and apply that standard. It wasn't disagreeing that the circuit wasn't applying the law as it was understood at the time. The dissenters, as I read what they were doing, was saying, send it back to the circuit and let them look at this in the first instance.
Well, as I understand it, Judge Cabranes didn't know the decision was done until he read it in the newspaper and then asked to look at it. And his opinion, joined by five other judges supporting en banc review, opens with these words, quote, this appeal raises important questions of first impression in our circuit and indeed in the nation regarding the application of the 14th Amendment and Title VII's prohibition on discriminatory employment practices, unquote. Was he wrong?
That was his view. He expressed it in his opinion,
right,
on his vote. I can't speak for him. I know that the
I'm just asking you to speak for you. Look, when the Supreme Court reversed you, Justice Kennedy wrote, quote, this action presents two provisions of Title VII to be interpreted and reconciled with few, if any, precedents in the courts of appeals discussing the issue, unquote. He was referring to the lack of precedent anywhere in the country, not just the Second Circuit. Was he wrong?
He was talking about whether I understood him to be talking about not whether the precedent that existed would have determined the outcome as the panel did, but whether the court should be looking at these two provisions in a different way to establish a choice, a different choice in considerations by the city. As I indicated, that argument about what new standard or new approach to the questions that the city should consider before it denies certification of a test, yes, had not been addressed by other courts, but the ability of a city, when presented with a prima facie case, to determine whether or not it would attempt to reach a non-disparate impact had been recognized by the courts.
Okay, if even the district court acknowledged that this was an unusual case, and if there was little or no Second Circuit precedent directly on point for a case like this, you know, one of the questions that I had is why did your panel not just do your own analysis and your own opinion? Judge Cabranes pointed out that the per curiam approach that simply adopts the district court's reasoning is reserved for cases that involve only, quote, straightforward questions that do not require explanation, unquote. As I asked you about a minute ago, you yourself joined an opinion regarding rehearing, saying the case raised difficult questions. Now, the issue that I'm raising is why did you not analyze the issues yourself and apply what law existed to the difficult and perhaps unprecedented cases or issues in the case? And whether you got it right or wrong, and the Supreme Court did find that you got it wrong because they reversed, I just can't understand the claim that you were just sticking to binding, clear, longstanding precedent when all of that was part of the total decision, and all nine justices found it to be a flaw that you didn't, you know, that you didn't give serious, adequate consideration to what really turned out to be a case of first impression. Look, it's easy always to look at these things in retrospect, and you're under a lot of pressure here, but I just wanted to cover that case because I think it's important that that case be covered. And I think it's also important for you to know how I feel about these type of cases, and I think many here in the United States Senate, these are important cases. These are cases where people are discriminated against. And let me just make one last point here. You have nothing to do with this, I know. But there's a rumor that People for the American Way has, that this organization has been smearing Frank Ritchie, who was only one of 20 plaintiffs in this case, because he may be willing to be a witness in these proceedings. I hope that's not true.
Frank Ritchie, by the way, will be a witness in the Sotomayor confirmation hearings, we believe, on Thursday. Ritchie, the plaintiff in that New Haven firefighters discrimination case. We are nearing the end of the half hour of questioning by Senator Orrin Hatch of Judge Sotomayor, and we are at the end of the Brian Lehrer Show for today. So you now have a choice. If you want to continue to listen to the hearings, we have it live on our website. You can go to WNYC.org. for the live stream of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings, or of course you can stay on the radio and listen to the Leonard Lopate Show coming up next on 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. Lisa Allison, Jody Abergan, Paige Cowett produced this program. Annie Schreffler is our Uncommon Economics editor, and our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. I'm Brian Lehrer.